used infection. How did he determine that that's what
from symptoms? He determined from symptoms. And we're going to look at that real carefully during this class. Symptoms are just one of the ways that you can, yeah, there are really no blood tests or stool tests for that. Because, so as we talked about the psychological upset that she got her life back, let me tell you about the stool test. With this Stefan, as we talked about, when I mentioned to the mother that maybe an antifungal might help him with his behaviors, she said that she had, 2 years ago, had read about the fungus-autism relationship. And she, Dr. Edelson, who still is in the field, was in Oregon at the time, and he was believing very much this relationship existed. And so he had his parents send in stool samples of the children. And so, and he tested them for yeast and fungus. And she said, and Stefan didn't test to have any. And I said, well, you know, what hurt, what does it hurt? There's no bottom line, no hurting with an antifungal therapy. We all feel good with that, feel better. And so when she did the therapy, the remarkable changes were there. It's very difficult to test because we all have a certain amount of fungus and yeast in our system, we should. Oh, you count the colonies. You hope that particular blood sample or urine sample or feces sample had enough colonies in to get you in the range. What are your chances? So it's symptoms. So he went and he looked at her symptoms. He said the number one cause of depression in women is of fungus overgrowth and often in men. And the number two would be thyroid deficiency. So he checked the thyroid deficiency and that wasn't there. So he had the symptoms of the fungus overgrowth. So I just wanted to stop there, just to have you know, these aren't just words. The metabolic upset manifests as psychological upset. Real stuff, big things, life-changing things can occur with that. We're going to treat nutritional imbalances with diet and nutritional supplements, think vitamins, to maximize a child's brain function, to enhance response to other treatment approaches. Knowing this is not in any means the only treatment approach, we need that whole team. But the always we hear from speech therapists, from OT and such, is, whoa, they're responding this amazingly. In this one story about a mom, she said that they were with their son who had severe autism, who had basically hardly even echolalia. They couldn't even get him to say, to try to even repeat any of their sounds. She said they'd had a team meeting, and the baseline was 5% of the time. Could he even repeat any of the sounds? And they've been working on this and working on this, and then she said they had wonderful speech and OT people coming in, and they were part of a team, and they said, okay, we're going to try this, we're going to try that, but we really don't know what to do. And the next week, they came back, and because they were, I don't know if it was a once a week or twice a week, and she said, speech therapist just came running out of the room and saying, I can't believe it. What is it? What is it? Everything she said, he said, just like that. What did you do? And that's when she added the enzymes. So all of a sudden, he was breaking down food so that he was getting fed for the first time ever, and speech came. So the team, of course, should notice it. If the team doesn't notice it, then nothing we are doing in our intervention really counts because it has to be noticeable. So the biomedical treatments is this. These are the things that moms do on their own many times, sometimes with help from a health professional. But when we need some, the biomedical help is to use lab tests to find and treat underlying medical conditions that are contributing to this aberrant behavior, such as subclinical anemia. Talk about a lot about that after a while. Dr. Sydney Walker found out that 40% of the kids have subclinical anemia, meaning hemoglobin and hematocrit doesn't measure it. Hemoglobin and hematocrit will be normal. Ferritin levels, which are the iron binding capacity of the blood, will be low. And then, particularly with kids who exhibit Asperger's type of symptoms, it's just like they can join the world. And we've seen that so many times. They just join in. They're suddenly engaged. Their eyes are bright. Why? Because, remember, what does joining in and engaging require? Energy. One of the reasons for their inability to join in a group could be that what we know something's sapping their energy, what could it be? It could very well be a subclinical anemia. And oftentimes it's, you know, it exhibits in the form of pica, where they'll eat dirt. What are they eating dirt? What's in dirt? Minerals. the coating of the crust of the earth has minerals in it. So then we know they respond very well to all the orotates, and to zinc, and to iron, and to calcium, magnesium, and lithium, which is natural to the human body. All of those, and all of a sudden they're fed. And you'll just see, and I've had teachers say, it's like they used to be in the periphery all the time, or like in the periphery of the classroom, or periphery of outside, and all of a sudden they're engaging. And those things have to pass. So clinical anemia, those are some good tests to do. Test for intestinal malabsorption. Acid reflux. How many kids do we have now that have acid reflux? Do you know, we heard of a child just the other day who's an infant, 6 months old, on Zantac. What's going on? We're getting a lot of gastrointestinal upsets from our little guys. A lot of it's manifesting in this aberrant behavior. Starts out with acid reflux. One of the reasons we believe that these kids limit their diet so much, they're down to 7 foods, all carbs, always. And what happens is they're just limiting, the pains, it's all pain aversion, but they can't tell you acid reflux, but it's happening. So many of those things are affecting infections. Sometimes they have a roaring infection. Clostridia is an infection that oftentimes people don't test for, that these kids have. They're finding that whole articles written on the correlation between Lyme disease and autism. A huge correlation that they're finding, that they respond real well to the long-term antibiotics they have to use, the other things that they use to get rid of that.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what was that infection that you said?
Clostridia.
Oh, Clostridia, okay.
C-L-O-S.
Yeah.
Often high metal levels. We're talking about, that's why the vaccination talk came up, because these kids have high metals. They high cadmium, high aluminum, even high arsenic. You know, we have arsenic in our water. But why do they hold on to it? High lead, all those types of things they have. High mercury. Mercury is one of the things that is very high, but not the only metal that's high. And so why do they have high metals? Are they just licking pipes all the time? Or could they not detoxify? So what are the other things they can test for? Food allergies and sensitivities. It used to be if they didn't have an allergy, said, okay, no problem. Now we find sensitivities and intolerances will bring reactions just the same as a true food allergy will. And neurotransmitter imbalances. They don't have the neurotransmitters available. So a dietary and biomedical are two of the ways that we can alternatively treat these guys. What's the treatment goal? Everybody's treatment goal would be the same. Move the child close to normal functioning, reduce some of the challenges associated with the disability, and recover. What do we call recover? Improvements into the average range for most skills with support systems in place. And that's the goal, is the recovery. This is the autism belief system held by DAN doctors and other health professionals who are into this new way of thinking, which isn't particularly new. DAN stands for Defeat Autism Now. A group of physicians got together, started by Bernard Rimland of his Autism Research Institute in San Diego. And they said there are a group of physicians whose children were affected by this syndrome. And they wanted to begin to search things out. And they began to get together and refine tests and began to catalog commonalities in symptoms that these kids have. You know, by the way, we'll talk about this later with essential fatty acids. One of the common factors they're finding with autistic children is that they have very low cholesterol levels. Cholesterol levels below 160. When they can get their cholesterol levels up, behaviors change. What does cholesterol do? It's what the makeup of the myelin sheath. The myelin sheath that coats the nervous system. They're finding many chemical and biochemical abnormalities that are common among this population. So what is the belief system of these health professionals? Their belief is based on their experience, is that autism and other disorders in the autistic spectrum disorders are primarily medical disorders with behavioral and cognitive impairments that are byproducts of the physical illness that these children suffer. Isn't that a different way to think about it? The behavior manifestations are a byproduct of having, like, this would say, having brain measles. This how I think of it, having brain measles. By the way, one of the reasons the MMR vaccination is so implicated, and that's the most reports that parents get, they were finally told they had their MMR. It's a common, not always, of course, just common report. And they have found, actually, when they look for viral, you know, they titrate and find the viruses that are high in these children, measles is one of them. A lot of measles in the guts of these kids that are being held there. So did that, were they ready, apparently, for that introduction? So we introduce an immunization for the immune system to respond, don't we, with an antibody, assuming that immune system is healthy. But if the immune system isn't healthy, it can't respond with an antibody. It just absorbs it, and it keeps creating havoc and havoc and havoc until it's treated. So we're going to look at some more of those things. And now we're going to look at one of the first theories is gastrointestinal disorders. Let's go ahead and take a break during this time. It'll take about, let's see, I have 7:05. What do you have? All the things that we talked about, one of the questions that you had during break was, but what causes autism? By the end of our time together here, I hope that we're able to give you at least 3 or 4 of the common causes of why we're seeing this epidemic rise in the kids on the ASD spectrum. And because we are seeing it all over, and the rise in kids with sensory integration issues, all of those kinds of things. We're going to hopefully have a lot of those answers. We talked in general, as in our introduction here, about all the various things that could be causative in nature. Now we're going to delve into them one by one and explore them and look at the research, then look at how kids are responding. The first one commonality that we see in these kids is that they all have gastrointestinal disorders. I mean, that is just one of the first things as the parents got together that they just noticed. All of them had stomach aches and upset. 90% of these wonderful children have a form of colitis, or chronic inflammation of the colon. In their babies, you know, when you wrap them tightly, all those kinds of things, so the colon hurts. And this is finally we've gotten enterologists involved so that they are being able to measure these things. It's just a real, real big issue with them. They often have bowel problems, present such as chronic diarrhea, most often, or constipation. If a fungal overgrowth is the biggest piece of it, it wants to manifest as a constipation. And many of these kids come with Miralax. Mm-hmm. But why would you give a Miralax when it is because they have a magnesium deficiency? Magnesium is nature's tranquilizer, and it's a natural laxative. But why would they have a magnesium deficiency? The fungus in yeast overgrowth is a Pac-Man, and the number one mineral it eats is magnesium. When you're low in magnesium, you're so sound and light sensitive that everything bothers you. Adults are very often low in magnesium. It's a common mineral deficiency when noise bothers you. All the commotion around you bothers you. You just want to shut yourself down. That's the magnesium deficiency. And so many times the magnesium, when we can give that, and that helps the child's nervous system relax, of course their bowels relax too. And then we see that difference. So when it's diarrhea, then we tend to look at other pathogens in the gut, our total malabsorption. Many of the parents said either when they changed their diet to gluten-free and dairy-free, that made a big change in the bowels, not diarrhea. Or if they did the enzymes that broke down the dairy and the gluten, then the diarrhea stopped. So that's a very important consideration. As long as that's going on, other outside symptoms will. That's a question.
I'm not sure this is connected perhaps to the autism. But I also had a student last year who had, for the first time, I had only heard this for the first time, she had irritable bowel syndrome, which is a gastrointestinal disorder. So is that, could that be kind of connected to any of this?
Not all kids who have irritable bowel syndrome are on the ASD spectrum. But all kids who are on the ESD spectrum have irritable bowel syndrome, whether you call it colitis, upset stomach, problems with diarrhea or constipation. It's common. Yeah, it's one of the commonalities.
Would this be seen in, you know, like a regular, like an upper GI? Would they see, I'm thinking of a specific girl that I have who's autistic. She has terrible gastrointestinal pains, constantly clutching her stomach. Her parents are lower income, and the doctors, they've spent all their money. The doctors have done an upper GI. She's been seen. They're not seeing anything. We've taken away dairy, we've taken away gluten.
Okay, so the question is, he has a child who has just constant stomach aches, and they've done the upper GI, lower GI, all of that, taken away dairy, taken away gluten, it made no difference. That so reminds me of the students that I see. One reminds me of a teenager, and he had had the upper GI, the lower GI, had everything done, and they just couldn't decide what it was. One, it came, looked like maybe he had an H. pylori, they did some antibiotics, that didn't help. Then finally, the doctor said, I said, he needs probiotics. Began giving him that, but didn't give him the right kind.
Right.
And so it didn't get better. And so finally, when I got to see him, because he was on a waiting list, and so when I got to see him, we did a Reuteri. It's R-E-U-T-E-R-I. It's in the health food store. But it's the number one strain of probiotic that gets at those kinds of symptoms, particularly if it looks like H. pylori. Next time I talked to him, he said, I have been a year in pain. A year in the classroom where I just finally have to leave because I just had constant pain. They said that took care of it. And then his gastro guy said, well, if Reuteri does it, then we have another one that has the same strain, and he went on to that. A young man I had from Columbia, Mississippi, came, and his mother said, he came from learning issues, but she said he has constant stomach aches, and he wets the bed at night. He's 11. She said, don't talk about the stomach aches because it bothers him when you talk about it, because the stomach hurts more when you talk about it. Well, so we put him on the antifungal program and those types of things. And she called back in 3 weeks, and she said, well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is he has no more stomach aches, and he's not wetting the bed. The bad news is he was in the bathroom, and he said, Mom, come and look. And out of his feces were coming little bitty threads. He had a dog. The dog licked him and transferred what? Parasites. Mm-hmm. Now we deworm the dogs, but we forget to deworm the kids, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Parasites are common in these kids, particularly with those kinds of things. So one of the most common reasons for constant abdominal stress distress is fungus. Not the only, the second would be dairy, third would be gluten, but the first is a good antifungal. We're gonna go into that in great detail. So what do we see these kids have? Malabsorption of nutrients is a significant issue. I think Dr. McCandless and her Children with Starving Brains couldn't have given a better title than that. Starving brains. Why? Because the gut is starving. You're feeding them, but it might as well not be feeding. It could just be pouring it right down the drain for as little as they can absorb. And is that because we know it's inflamed? Isn't it inflamed because of the vaccinations and all the different viruses that they're holding inside their body? Could be. Could it be inflamed for other reasons? We're going to find out. But inflammation, we absolutely know is there. Johns Hopkins Institute found when they did MRIs and scans of autistic and Asperger's children, kids on the ASDs spectrum, what they found is all of them had inflammation in their brain, nervous system, gut. Inflammation was a hallmark of it. And so inflammation, you know, then that you just can't absorb. So all nutrients to feed the nervous system need to be first absorbed in the intestines. It's just the basics, isn't it? Just really the very basic things. Let's look at some more things about gastrointestinal. This is interesting that the extremely limited diet that these children have is often attributed to the gastrointestinal issues that they have. Remember, we wondered why they narrow their diet. In fact, one of the hallmarks is that they will narrow their diet. The more they narrow their diet, the sicker they get. The sicker they get, the more they narrow their diet. Until finally they'll be down to 7 foods, and it's all carbs. It'll be casein and gluten, won't it? Pizza, macaroni and cheese. They'll do french fries, sometimes chicken nuggets. Why chicken nuggets versus other food? What are chicken nuggets coated with?
The breading.
Yeah, with the breading. Let's see, sometimes ice cream, sometimes not, sometimes yogurt, sometimes not. Anyway, it's about 7 foods, all carbs, and if they crave what they're allergic to. And so it's just so typical. I'm going to show you later, we have an email from a mom said, did you hear the angels sing last night? The girl asked for meat the first time in 5 years, because finally she could start digesting things. So we know that celiac disease, they found, is much more common in kids who have the ASD disorder, autism, or Asperger's. Now, the one teacher came up with one class and said this. She said, you know what, for years I went for testing for celiac. I knew I had it, but I didn't test a positive for it. So I finally just stopped all gluten, and she said, all my stomach pains have stopped. So the testing isn't as good as we want it to be. There's another test they now call the GIT test, G-I-T, that they're doing. Your pediatrician can just do it. It's called the gluten irritation test, because they find a lot of these kids don't show allergic to it, but it irritates their nervous system. And so the GIT test is just an easy one to do. So we know that gastroenterologists are finding major malabsorption problems in these kids. Again, these kids who have starving brains. So we're going to look, when we come back tomorrow night, we're going to look at what a healthy gut looks like, what it's supposed to look like, and then as the aberrant things come in and change the, what we call it, dysbiosis, what begins to break down, what follows, what behaviors follow after that. So we're going to look at what does a healthy gut look like. And a healthy gut, which these wonderful children don't have, has a good balance of good bacteria and yeast and fungus. The mucosal lining is intact, causing good absorption of nutrients. Mucosal lining needs essential fatty acids to line that. And this is the interesting part, why it affects the emotional behavior area. Over 95% of that very important neurotransmitter, serotonin, is produced in the gut. And that was breakthrough research when Dr. Michael Gershon, a gastroenterologist, came to the conclusion and found out in a lab that over 95% of serotonin is made, manufactured in the gut or in the bowel. And why would we care about serotonin? Well, antidepressants recirculate serotonin, right? They're called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They just inhibit the reuptake of serotonin so there's enough for the brain to be able to function with. Doesn't make any more, it just continues to circulate more. Ritalin increases the amount of serotonin available in the brain. So you see, why do they need more? That they aren't manufacturing it. And many adults, many ADD kids, SI kids, ADHD kids, and many adults walking around aren't producing enough serotonin because we have gut problems, don't we? What's our number one selling medication, I think, now is all the anti-cholesterol medication, and number two is all the gut medication, Zantac, Prilosec, Prevacid. As I said, we even have six-month-olds on Zantac. What is happening? Why are we such a low serotonin society? So we're going to look at this some more. What a good gut looks like we said. It has good bacteria in there and good yeast or fungus, I mean, in a balance. And then the body says, if we don't affect this rainforest, we don't change the rainforest, it pumps out serotonin like crazy. Some people are high serotonin, others are low serotonin. I always say my husband could be a serotonin donor because he has serotonin all the time. Doesn't seem to matter what goes on extrinsically in his world. He just has that. So I think, you know, if we could go and get blood, I think we ought to give serotonin. I'd line up to get some. Fortunately, I live with one. So what does serotonin, this incredible good neurotransmitter, do? You know, we have about six major neurotransmitters. Serotonin is one of the major ones, one of the biggest ones. If you have enough serotonin in your body, you have a relaxed mind. Let's think of the opposite, the reciprocal with these kids. Let's think of kids who have high SI problems, where everything bothers them and tags and all of that bother them. That's not a relaxed mind, is it? We could think about, like Dee said, when she sees her Asperger's kids in middle school, what are they doing either during gym or during in the cafeteria, like you were saying, either wandering around the periphery, pacing, or doing other, what were the other things you said? They're either pacing in the cafeteria.
Running. Right, or they're off, most of them are off by themselves.
Are off
yeah.
by themselves. Why? Because all the noise and commotion
and in recess.
Yeah, yes, yeah. And in recess yeah. too, you're right. All the noise and commotion is too much, so they have to pull themselves away. No buffering system. When we give them a buffering system, this is what you see. You see them being able to join in. We don't have to have these children suffer as long as they are, now that we know some answers. So relaxed mind. If we have enough serotonin, we have that wonderful sense of well-being. All we know is that everything's going to turn out all right. What's the hallmark of these wonderful kids? Anxiety. Anxiety is very high. They are so internally anxious that they're having to work too hard at keeping calm. If you have enough serotonin, you can handle stress easily. You know, we have seen, even in adults, that, you know, you've all seen, one adult has just tragic things happen in their life. Another adult, you know, has bad things happen in their life. When tragic things happen in their life, they can seem to bounce back. The other person had some pretty bad things happen, not as tragic as the other one, and they just sunk. That we are often finding is what's the serotonin level. You have enough serotonin, you can come back and handle it. So it isn't the extrinsic things that are happening, it's intrinsically what your chemistry is like. We've known that for lots of years, which is why the medications have been so popular. So can these guys handle stress? Well, no, because often they can't even handle a tag in the back of their shirt. A sock is a big stress. Never mind a change in the classroom. If you have enough serotonin, you fall asleep easily, stay asleep all night, don't have nightmares, are night terrors. And one of the things that Dr. Michael Murray talks about in his 5-HTP book, he says that they've known for years that kids who have night terrors are low in serotonin. You know, night terrors are something to behold when the child just can't wake up. They're just like in a total another world. And we have found nightmares. I mean, everyone has nightmares because they've watched a bad movie. But we're talking nightmares a lot. So that's why falling asleep easily is not easy for them. At the Asperger's conference and autism conference that I went to, doc after doc got up there and told what they use with their families to help the children get to sleep and stay asleep all night. How do you know if a child has a good quality night's sleep? They wake up refreshed. When parents tell me, I'll ask them, how does that child wake up? They say, oh, grumpy and unhappy. How do the other children in your family wake up? Happy. If they all wake up grumpy, you say, are they getting to bed early enough? Is there a TV in their room? I mean, you'd look at those kinds of things. But barring those kinds of things, if this child's continually grumpy and unhappy when he wakes up, he's not getting a good quality night's sleep. And lots of kids will say they wake up during the night a lot, or they can't fall asleep. And serotonin is the neurotransmitter responsible for that. If you have enough serotonin, you easily stay focused, which is why Ritalin and antidepressants help to recirculate serotonin. If you have enough serotonin, you have control over your impulsivity. And that is a report that's actually not, as I found, written in any of the books about serotonin. But that's reports from parents. As we do some serotonin boosting natural things, they say, oh, their impulsivity has just gone down. Their judgment, their ability to judge and think things through. If you have enough serotonin, you see the world, perceive it as more positive than negative. And many of these kids are Eeyore. Oh, well. We have the cloud over me, but then that's the way it always is. Just an Eeyore. Nothing is really enough. Like one gal or one mom called and said, could it be a sign of serotonin if they're never satisfied? And that's true. That little satisfaction level requires the grease of serotonin to be able to work. Otherwise, it's just an empty bucket with a hole in it, and you just can't fill it up. Antidepressants do a nice job of releasing serotonin, and in fact, 1 out of 5 adults is on an antidepressant. Pharmacists have said in terms of, because we know that Ritalin releases it also, pharmacists have said that they write more prescriptions for Ritalin than they do for any other medication. Kind of a big deal, isn't it? Sertonin's a real big deal. And this is one of, we're going to talk later on at the end of the class about natural medicines. It's really nice to see that we have some natural medicines that work pretty well. Because as we were talking, some of the nurses we were talking before, there aren't a lot of medications that are working with this population. So we are looking for natural things. So what do we know about what sertonin does and where it's manufactured? And what are some of the symptoms? As we know, symptoms of low sertonin levels in children with autism in particular often look like this, the whirling. Why? Remember, why are they stimming? Remember that Dr. Michael Norton in his Beyond Prozac book, the psychiatrist, said that if they do constant motion like that, that's releasing sertonin, making them feel good. Remember, kids in disequilibrium, that gets them closer to equilibrium. It stimulates their vestibular system, and that releases, that whole thing releases more sertonin. Why do we know that, this is a low sertonin symptom? Because when we give natural things to boost their sertonin, the symptoms go away. So the whirling, the things we're familiar with, the flapping, pacing, we talked about. We have more in middle school. By the time we get to middle school, we're not doing a lot of whirling and flapping, but they're pacing. And one wonderful gal, a little 14-year-old, that I saw, and she was from Nebraska, and at the end of the session, it had been too long for her nervous system. And we have a large open space by the library where we meet, and she was just circling, circling. And the mother said, "If that doesn't bother you, it's really good if she does that, because she's self-calming." And why? Because there's not enough sertonin to release. She had run out of it. The rocking, the banging head, all those kinds of things are telling us that. Toe walking. I had one young fellow who came from California who was just darling. He came in, they came to the door, and he was, oh, I think only like 12. And yet he was as tall as his mother. I said, "Whoa. You're really tall, 12-year-old, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah, but that's because I'm standing on my tiptoes." I said, "Oh, so you are." So he never could go off his tiptoes, ever. And in fact, they had him scheduled for a surgery. And his hair, it's like he was wild, like he should be from California, a beach boy. And I'm commenting how, you know, this looks good, like good surfing hair. And the mother said, "Well, we just had a huge scene at the house, like holding down, you know, everything to get it out to here before it was like there." Because they have nerve endings in their hair. Because their whole system is so wired. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is there a relationship between self-injury and low serotonin levels?
Very good question. Is there a relationship between self-injury and low serotonin? That's right. I didn't put down all the symptoms here, and that was one of them. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and that can be, if again, not a big part of the population, but if it's your child or child you're working with, it's big.
So even though the pain, even though we're inflicting pain, it's worth it because of the serotonin release.
Yes, even though inflicting pain,
yes,
it's exactly. We do that as adults all the time, don't we? We do things that are really painful because of what the long-term result. So let's look at, if a child is low serotonin, we ask ourselves, why? Why is this child low serotonin? And we know, we look, first of all, do they have the food that makes serotonin? And we know the number one food is the essential fatty acids. Again, Dr. Michael Norton has helped us out a lot with this, as has Dr. Andrew Stoll from his Omega-3 Connection in Harvard. They all found, Dr. Michael Norton in his clinic, that for his adults that could not tolerate Prozac, or Wellbutrin, or Zoloft, or Elavil, all of those very good medications, they couldn't tolerate them because of the side effects, or they had non-compliance because of the side effects. He found that when he gave them high amounts of essential fatty acids, they could use such a small dose of the medicine that they didn't have side effects. Dr. Andrew Stoll from Harvard University found the same thing, found that bipolar, depression, postpartum depression, all were modulated by large amounts of the oils, much larger than we typically think. Many times I'll have parents come and they say, "Oh yes, we've been doing fish oils," and they definitely have, maybe one capsule. They're going to need about eight. In other words, the amount is large. We're going to look at the studies, the protocol amounts that have brought these changes around, about. But would be, of course, the best oil, not so they don't have to take a lot of pills, would be cod liver oil. Didn't we used to eat cod liver oil? Let's think about that. If we have kids with a compromised immune system who can't even handle vaccinations. By the way, the MMR, remember the doctor I talked about, who's, the mother said, you broke him, now you fix him? You know, the MMR doesn't have thimerosal in it. So he was reacting to the immune hit. So why are these kids born with poor immune systems? One theory is Dr. Leo Galland in Super Immunity for Kids is a pediatrician. It's a wonderful book I have in the back of your manual, all those different books listed. You can get it in the library. How does he say to build the immune system of these children? Essential fatty acids. We used to do that. Didn't we always have cod liver oil? Didn't the kids get liver once a week? All those things just greatly benefited their immune / nervous system. Now instead, we give them all fried foods, which displace the receptor in the receptor site. It displaces the good oils, but it doesn't feed the system at all. So we get French fries, we get all the fried foods, and our low-fat society has been a very hard thing on our children. And has it helped cholesterol? If that would be the case, that wouldn't be the number one selling medication, would it? So it's just some things to consider. What are we doing so that our children's immune system are compromised? You know, and we talked about this could be asthma of the brain or measles of the brain. We're seeing asthma increase like crazy, aren't we? Not only increase, we're seeing much more serious asthma, aren't we? Much more serious asthma than we ever did before. So many more deaths actually from asthma. Shouldn't we be making progress with that? Well, yes, except the volume is so high. We get that much volume, of course you're just going to have more kids in trouble. So, and what? Childhood diabetes. All those immune system diseases are rising. Autism is just one of them. Are the spectrum disorders are just one. So that's saying, since we know the immune system and nervous system want to react the same, what are we doing to that child's immune system? What did we used to do to kids before? Wasn't it, didn't they, we feed them? Wouldn't we say, what would be the number one change? Wouldn't it have to be food? Mm-hmm. We could say, well, mothers are going back to work, but that's been going on a long time, hasn't it? The only connection I can see to mothers going back to work is, what do you have less time to do?
To cook.
And so everything's in a package. If it's in a package, it will have denatured fats in it, because it has to be denatured. Because the really good essential fatty acids that feed the nervous system and the brain have life in them, which means anything of life has to be refrigerated. And so what these oils and all these fats and those types of things, Eggos and all the kinds of things that they eat in the morning, Lego would be a little crunchy, wouldn't it? So when they eat those kinds of things, they're preserved. And so the good part is taken out so they don't go rancid. As a result, it's feeding that part of the brain. It's taking the receptor site of that part of the brain. So once we can get, in fact, I just got an email today from a mom that I had called. So every Thursday, I'm on a board, and I call people all across the United States. I return calls. And I do that one day a week, just consultations as I can through telephone. So anyway, this mother said, I can't tell you the difference. Last week we had talked to you about Hannah. I can't remember Hannah's age. She was 12 or 13, I think. And she said, the difference in Hannah, when we just changed the diet, like you said, even in 1 week. So they stopped having pancakes for breakfast. You know, we wouldn't give them birthday cake and think we're feeding them. Well, but we put a pan in front of the word cake and we feel pretty righteous about it, even though as far as the brain is concerned, it's the same thing in the body. So she said, just changing that and taking away the sugar, she said, it's just amazing. I thought she was going through normal pubescence kind of mood swing. She said, now she's happy. Before, I could never get her to do her homework. Now she sits down and does it. And then she went on and she had some other questions. If I could take that one statement, I would say I could multiply that by 1,000 times in the last 10 years, the emails I've gotten like that. I mean, I've seen 2,000 you know, children in consultation in the last 10 years. And then all the others I talked to by telephone get a lot of feedback. So does diet affect how these kids respond? Hugely. Just hugely. One dad, I just see him so clearly in my mind, he came to one of the consultations, and he had this wonderful 9-year-old boy. He was a little Korean boy, and they had adopted him, and he was there with the wife, and he and as I was working with this boy, I wasn't finding things that were really alarming me, not enough to come in for a consultation. And I said, tell me again what it was that you're concerned about. And he said, well, nothing now on this date, because you're not seeing the young boy that we usually see. I said, well, tell me why. He said, because for 3 weeks we've given him no sugar. He said, but we want to know how we can change that. We can't live like that. And it's true. I mean, you're going to fall off the wagon. It's going to happen. So I showed him how he could help his child's immune system so he could handle some sugar. So what did he have? Beef jerky for breakfast. They had tuna for lunch. I mean, basically the Atkins diet, right? Now, we know that that isn't healthy for kids to be on, you know, a long time, not more than a week at any rate. So we need to find more natural things than we did. But do you see what he told me? What do you hear? The change in this child's remarkable. We couldn't get him to focus on anything. We thought he had dyslexia. We thought he had auditory processing problems. We thought he had everything. But we found it was just focusing. Now that he can focus, he can read. So just as an educator, you see, I didn't want to hear those things because I was really into the education and therapy and brain integration therapy and different kinds of therapy that worked. But I went on to get a nutritionist degree because I realized there was a trump card. And the trump card is the chemistry of the child. And it's been pretty much borne out by all these wonderful parents. So one of the foods that converts to serotonin is essential fatty acids. If anybody is taking an antidepressant, any adult, they want to take essential fatty acids, particularly fish oils, and fish oils in high amounts. Now, if you can, the most pure would be cod liver oil. They have lemon flavored, orange flavored, even chocolate flavored. I'm not impressing you at all, am I? Or you could eat liver once a week. Liver and onions used to be a standard in the world. Or you could take capsules, because that's what you were trying, wanting to hear, weren't you? But my SI kids can't take capsules, so we have to figure out ways. So if they're low serotonin, I say to myself, okay, I see low serotonin symptoms. This child is working harder to be comfortable in their own skin. What are the things I'm looking for? Number one, do they have the food? And that is essential fatty acids. You'll find that much research on that.
What are the natural foods that are more high in essential fatty acids?
The foods that are higher in essential fatty acids, and we have that coming up a lot more later,
okay,
when we're going to talk about diet.
Okay, thank you.
But it would be food, nothing that's in a package. So it would be lots of fish. In fact, Dr. Jacqueline Storti, who found that dyslexics are always tremendously low in essential fatty acids, they pass that down, which is why they tend to pass down the dyslexia. And you know, dyslexia is an immune system hit also because they have more thyroid problems, more diabetes, more arthritis in their families. She realized essential fatty acids played a role prior to making the formulations for her study. She had her son eat fish every day. Reading got better. So of course fish does, grains do, whole grains, mayonnaise, real mayonnaise. How many of you get the low-fat mayonnaise? Remember, if it's low-fat, it's high-carb. Is what they fill it in with. And carbs are disastrous for these guys in large amounts. And navy beans. Beans are wonderful. Brown rice. All the food that is probably not right in your pantry right now. And so as you take out white rice and put in brown, you will get an essential fatty acids. As you take out the white bread and put in whole grain, you'll get essential fatty acids. Olive oil is wonderful, but it's an omega-6.
Okay.
I think it's great. It's really good to include in your diet,
right.
But it's not the DHA that feeds the brain and nervous system. But it's also very good. They need all the oils.
All the salmons and the...
Uh-huh. All the salmons and the tunas and the sardines and all those types of things. Yes. So what's another food that we're going to talk about later at the end of the class, which would be a natural medicine? We know that tryptophan is an amino acid. It's an amino acid that when it's broken down by enzymes in the body, it converts to a substance called 5-hydroxytryptophan. Actually, it goes one step before that, 5-hydroxytryptamine, then 5-hydroxytryptophan. Then that turns in 45 minutes into serotonin. And we are going to look at that with our natural medicine after a while. But right now, when we look at tryptophan, which you probably have heard, you know, after Thanksgiving dinner, everybody all settled down and relaxed after the turkey. Well, basically, just to let people know that tryptophan is made from the amino acids, which means protein, right? What do these children eschew? What do they shy away from? Protein and meat. That's right, because they're doing it as a self-protective mechanism, because their gut does not break down the protein. And so they just feel awful after they have it. So they don't say, by the way, Mom, when I take that hamburger, it just makes me feel awful, I can't break it down. They just say, no, don't want it. And they'll just eat the bun, you know, they'll only eat the carbs. And so many of our kids are carnivores, particularly our SI kids and everything after that. So what they are, they're going to be naturally low in the amino acids. Some kids eat a lot of protein but can't break it down. It's essentially like they are. So then we say that low serotonin, again, what did we do to this child's manufacturing plant? Why is his sister or brother making serotonin? This child isn't. Let's look at the manufacturing plant. And again, that's the gut, and that's Dr. Michael Gershon's research that has been so helpful. So let's look at what goes on in the gut. And we know that in the gut we have good bacteria, we have good yeast and fungus, and then that pumps out serotonin like crazy. But we know that there are times when that becomes unbalanced. And let's look at what causes that to be unbalanced. This research has been so helpful in learning about how to help these wonderful children that were just an exciting area to talk about. In fact, when yesterday when you were talking about, Kim was talking about her daughter who had, she said it looked like she had all the symptoms of depression, etc., but she was able to get rid of the symptoms with these natural things. Now doesn't she know a lot more for her kids and for the children that she teaches? When we have good bacteria and good yeast, is not, we don't have a problem. But what happens when we have, what is a mold? Think yeast, fungus, mold. What, how do we change this and cause the dysbiosis? With antibiotics, right? Because antibiotics are what? Mold. As a result, it just makes a real nice moldy situation in there. Let me just get this. So what we know is when a child has antibiotics, that it causes this to multiply. Because antibiotics are mold, and they found out that mold will kill bacteria. So it not only kills the bacteria that is causing the ear infection, a bladder infection, kids will have reflux, that type of thing, but it's indiscriminate. So the first thing it does is kill the bacteria that's in the gut. Now, if you just have an antibiotic once in a while and you have a good immune system, you right yourself. Pretty soon you balance out. You have some yogurt, it all turns out well for you. What happens with these children is often, and in fact we found this to be huge with this population, is they've had back-to-back antibiotics or prophylactic use of antibiotics because of an ongoing ear infection or because of kidney reflux. And in fact, in my population that I have seen, and I can't say I have seen the most ADS kids of anybody, but I see a good number of them. When a child, the more they're manifesting symptoms, the more I know the likelihood that that mother had antibiotics in utero. I send out a questionnaire, but in the questionnaire, it's not one of the questions I have, because they have 10 questions. If I had more than that, the mothers wouldn't return the questionnaire. So I have to just narrow down. So I finally say, tell me, with this child, did you have, because this child is different than the others in the family, did you have antibiotics? No, I don't think so. Oh, yes, I had that sinus infection. or no, I don't think, oh, that was the child with the bladder infection. So what happens? Mom gets this overgrowth of yeast in her gut, and that, of course, goes into the child. Mom has a good immune system, so it can be balanced. The child, the baby's immune system, is not developed. And so then that child begins to have dairy allergy right away, has projectile vomiting, all the kinds of things that come from having this dysbiosis. The other thing that I found out, and as a, you know, my consultations take 5 or 6 hours, and people always, when they come in, they can't believe they're going to be there that long. And by the end, we can't believe that we're running out of time, because all we have to dig and find out. Sometimes it takes that long for mom to remember, oh, that's the one that I had the vaginal yeast infection all the way through the pregnancy. Same thing as having antibiotics. That affected the child. Because when I see a large manifestation, I know that assault was in utero. Remember what they said with autism, Asperger's, the ASD spectrum. What they found was, what are the causations? One of the things they know, genetics and what? Environmental insult. From these kids that are more affected, the insult occurred in utero. For the kids that are less affected, the insult occurred when they were first born. They ran and IVs because they have meconium in their body, or aspirated some mucus or such. We've always thought of antibiotics as fairly innocuous. We know they're life-saving. We're so glad we have them. They save lives. We didn't realize the fallout. The fallout is neurological. Yes, we know thrush. Yes, we know the need for nystatin. But we didn't realize the nervous system, the hit the nervous system was taking. So that's just what I found in my own practice. So then when I was reading it in these and hearing it from these other docs, I thought, that's exactly what I have seen. And so what happens is, if mom has that, or if mom should have a steroid. I had one mom who came and she had 2 children on the ASD spectrum. You don't see that a lot, the 2 in a family. And so I thought, what kind of hit? That had to be, you know, one step higher. And I said, did you have steroids? She said, for both of them, I had steroids for 6 weeks because they're afraid they were coming for early and they were trying to build up their lungs. Good reasoning, right? But as a result, nothing will grow yeast faster than steroids. And how many children do we have that are just casually taking Rhinocort or Nasocort, which are all cortisones, and they're just saying, well, that keeps inflammation down. Yes, and a sledgehammer would get a pin in a bulletin board too, but maybe that's not necessary. There's a big fallout from that. And in fact, I believe that a lot of what we're seeing, one of the causations is the cavalier use of antibiotics and steroids unopposed. You know, we wouldn't give unopposed estrogen to a woman with her uterus, right? We would give progesterone with it. We know proliferation requires that be cleaned out. We need to have a balance. But we give unopposed antibiotics. Antibiotic proliferation of yeast without the cleaning out of that overgrowth. Many times I'll have pharmacists, you know, they didn't deliberately come, they just happened to be a pharmacist, and I'm seeing the child for learning or behavior issues. And I'll just say, you know, there's one thing that you could do that would help a tremendously large group of kids. Every time you give a prescription of antibiotics, in their pharmaceutical area, they have something called Lactinex, which is like an acidophilus. It's only a couple strains, not as good as what you can get in a health food store, but it's much better than nothing. I said, would you just tell the parent, could you, is that in your, you know, realm, could you tell the parent, would you get, it best if you get this Lactinex with it, give it not only all the way through the antibiotic treatment, but at least 2 weeks after, multiple times a day, even though it says once a day on there. And all the pharmacists said, yes, of course I could do that. Just think how many kids we've impacted with just that one piece of knowledge for someone who affects so many families. You never take unopposed antibiotics. Stefan, the young man that we talked about at the beginning of the class, the fellow who was 9 years old, and they said at first autistic and then Asperger's, and then went on to become homecoming king, as we talked about, he had one downturn in there. one downturn when his mother forgot what had caused all of this. And he had acne. So she went to the doctor and he gave him tetracycline, a very strong, broad-spectrum antibiotic designed to totally clear the gut out of all good bacteria and bad bacteria. All of a sudden, he started getting strange behaviors. And the cutting, you know, started all of that. They were going to go see a psychologist and all that. I said, well, that's fine. Of course, still do that. But do you remember what caused that in the first place? She said, oh, my goodness. So began to, again, never unopposed antibiotics. So gave him the probiotics to begin to plant back in. And then the best thing to do is, if you need an antibiotic, just topical. Just get a topical roll-on, erythromycin, never a systemic. It's not worth it because it's just such a huge hit for these guys. So we see that the yeast and fungus overgrows, whether it begins in utero or it begins later on. Oftentimes they won't have their first ear infection or their first need for antibiotics until they have their first formula, their first chance to have dairy in their system. And that's why I always ask parents, when did the ear infections first occur? Because that tells us a lot. Because we know that this yeast is very opportunistic. It will grow and grow and grow and grow and take over just as much of the community, the garden, so to speak, as it can. And the less good bacteria we have, the less we can digest food. And then what they have is, pretty soon, they have the food that is not mother's milk. And they have dairy. And what happens is, some of that goes through undigested. They don't have the good antibiotic, the good bacteria, to digest it. And some of that goes through the intestinal wall. Why? Because these this overgrowth of yeast had grown into like little tiny mushrooms and created what's called microscopic, we know it's microscopic, lesions or permeations in the gut wall, and they call it the leaky gut syndrome. So they have the dairy and some of it's not digested, and do you know an allergen is almost always to a protein? So we say they're lactose intolerant. It's not the lactose that's the problem, it's the protein. Because, yep, they get better with the lactose, maybe the lactate you give them, but it's not usually the whole problem. So it goes through the gut undigested, and the mast cells then produce histamine. And we're going to look at the role of histamine, which in these kids is just huge. So what happens when these children get the dairy and they can't break it down, and they become allergic to it, we get all sorts of manifestations. There are wonderful physical manifestations that just tell the story, if we just knew how to read it. Projectile vomiting, dairy allergy. Colic, dairy allergy. Stomach aches in kids, you think dairy allergy. Eczema, you think dairy allergy. Rashes, all of those. Multiple ear infections. In Marianne Bloch's book, No More Ritalin, and she has another one, amoxicillin. She talks about how in her clinic in Texas, no patient ever has more than one ear infection. Why? Because she takes them off dairy. Dairy is mucus forming, as we know. Remember, if your child has a cold, you go in, they say take them off of dairy. Because dairy creates what? It creates phlegm. And so you can get 1% phlegm, or 2% phlegm, whole phlegm, chocolate phlegm, cheddar phlegm, mozzarella phlegm, Ben and Jerry's phlegm. You can get goat phlegm, you can get raw phlegm. It's still phlegm. And so what happens for these guys is they say, okay, we'll put tubes in their ears. Well, why? What if we had a drainage ditch and we had the large concrete tube and all of a sudden we had one whole drainage area that didn't drain. It was getting clogged up all the time. The men were out there always cleaning it up. Do you think they'd dig it up and put in another tube, another pipe? What would they look at? Why is that? Why is the viscosity of the liquid going through the pipe different than it is over here? And what do we know? Now what do? They put in enzymes all the time, don't they, to break down the debris. Well, we would say, okay, why does that child need tubes? What is the viscosity of the mucus in there? Why is that so thick? Don't they call it glue ear? Yeah, what was causing that? It's an allergy to dairy. They don't have the enzymes to break it down, and they're reacting to the protein in it. So we see that they are allergic. And so I have parents often say, in fact, I get this so many times in my consultations, they say, you know, they used to have a dairy allergy, but they can handle it now. But they're coming to me because either they have ADD or ADHD, or their SI is so interfering with their way of life, or they have dyslexia or dysgraphia. And I say, you know, I wish the dairy allergy manifestation stayed the same. If it stayed the same, wouldn't it be easy? It'd be like a no-brainer, huh? Okay, gives them a stomachache every time. But no, later on, they don't get a stomachache. But they get what's called cerebral allergies. Dr. Philpott has a whole book on cerebral allergies, an MD who realized it affects the nervous system. If it would stay physical, we'd recognize it. But it goes into, remember, that emotional, mental realm, and then it's a whole new animal as far as we're concerned. But in reality, it isn't. So once allergic to dairy, always allergic to dairy. It just is a different manifestation. About 3 weeks ago, I had a gentleman come with his wife from out of state, and they came to the door, and he said a remarkable statement when he walked in. He said, if you do nothing for us in this consultation, you will already have changed our lives. I said, well, what did I do? And he said, we heard you talk on the symptoms of dairy allergy. And we decided that was our daughter. And again, I think she was around 12. And he said, so we decided, and he said, at first I sat there and listened and said, that can't be true, because milk is a good food. We read the ads. Those actors wouldn't lie to us, would they? With that milk mustache? We know. So I said, no, that can't be right, he told his wife. Milk is a good food. They said, truly it is. We're not like against milk. We're just against what it's doing in this child. So he said, so we decided to go dairy-free. And she was just a real copacetic little girl, so she went with it. But she was having learning problems, not behavior problems. But it didn't look like behavior problems. It looked like learning problems. She was struggling to read, had dyslexic-like symptoms still. Keeping was pinky. I mean, everything was turning around for her. And see, so as I was testing her, he said, we've just seen such a change in her. So as I was testing her, of course, they had sent in the earlier testing. It had been done not very long ago. So I just expected to get pretty much about the same testing. I just wanted to see how it was going to come out. And as I was testing her, I said, this doesn't match at all. This is on grade level. And he said, yep, that's one of the changes we've seen is no dairy. And then I was doing something else. I said, but your questionnaire says this. I'm not saying, yeah, that would be the other thing that we have seen with no dairy. And we went through that. So do you see why we look at, and of course she had had early antibiotic use that set her up for the leaky gut so that she became allergic. Now they're realizing that all food allergies are emanating from the gut. So instead of just first taking away allergens, if we heal the gut, they're not going to be allergic to everything. Otherwise, if you take your child there, these parents have, all of these parents with these children who are struggling to this degree, take their children in for allergy testing, and a very good thing to do. And we're going to talk about the specific allergy testings later on and what they do. But they take them in, and generally they come back with they're allergic to like 30 foods, kiwi, strawberry.
Yes, if you heal the gut, can you introduce what they were allergic to?
The question is, if we heal the gut, can we introduce what they're allergic to before? And we're going to cover that in great detail down the line, too. And so what we know is that as they get allergic to so many foods, well, then what do? These kids are already only eating about, 15 foods maybe. When they get real sick, they narrow to 7. Well, you take those away, what are you going to do? So that's why we need to heal the gut first, so they're not going to just look like they're allergic to everything. Then we'll get the big ones, and we're going to look at which are the big ones and such. But first we're looking here at the etiology. Where do allergies start? Many times people say, no, they just have some hay fever. Environmental allergies will always be secondary to food allergies. The food allergy is sitting on their immune system, making their immune system responsive, and then they're responsive to seasonal things. So whether it's a big response or a little response, that is the way that goes. So we see that this proliferates, and then it puts off toxins, and the toxins are like acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde is blocks the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, which is the memory neurotransmitter, and it makes you spacey. And in fact, one of the big hallmarks of a fungal yeast overgrowth is spaciness. It's that just know things one day, the next day they don't. So what do we know? What feeds yeast? Every once in a while, people will say, you know what, they only had their antibiotics from 0 to 3. They're 11 and 12 years old now. They haven't had one since. But they don't need to have one because they're feeding that little garden nicely. And what are they feeding it with? Sugar. Yeah. So they become, and if sugar isn't available, carbs will do. So they become carnivores. And they want cereal, like they say, oh yeah, he'll have all cereal all day. Or a cup of soups. A cup of soups all day. Or all he wants is pancakes. They're craving that. They crave the sugar because the yeast demands it. The more sugar they have, the more the yeast proliferates. And that's why we see, we get many calls right after Christmas, and certainly after Halloween, you know, and sometimes we call it Harvest Festival. It doesn't matter what we call it, it's all about sugar. And for these kids that are sugar reactors, and you'll see that those are the ones you see in the cafeteria when they're the ones our little guys are pacing, they are having, if you look, all they'll have are French fries. They wouldn't go near a hamburger or anything else. So just look at their trays. And some of my teacher friends and I have done that, been in the cafeteria and watched our children. And they're not doing the proteins or the carrot sticks or the fruit. They are doing the carbs and the sugar. Now, so why can some kids have carbs and sugar the same amount as this child and not have the reactions? Because they don't have this setup in their gut. So then they can process it. And oftentimes our firstborn is stronger in general because our immune system, the immune system of the mom, appears to be stronger the first time. Subsequent pregnancies tend to be different, particularly if they're close together. Close together pregnancies make it a little trickier for the second one, unless, like we had in our family with my daughter, with the second one, she decided to take a lot of vitamins and eat differently. Second one, stronger then. Stronger constitution can take more environmental hits. So these are guys whose constitution isn't as strong as we want it to be. So we're saying, how can we know that ahead of time? So we don't assault them with antibiotics unless it's life-threatening. You know, over 50% of the ear infections clear up, as you know, without antibiotics because they're viral in nature. In fact, I have many parents who said, I used to do antibiotics all the time for my children for ear infection. Either they took them off dairy, they figured that out, and that took care of it, or they used garlic drops in the ear, or grapefruit seed extract drops in the ear, or elderberry. They use natural things. Ear infections respond very nicely to natural things generally. So then they don't need to do that. So if we know a child is immune compromised, if we see these steps coming up in a pregnancy, do you see how then I think we can keep from getting more kids who are in disequilibrium? Because we can be wise about our immunizations. Either put them off, cut them in half, don't do them, give them, as long as you're going to give them lots of vitamin C so they can detoxify. Let's not just randomly assault their immune system if we see anything that makes us think that maybe this child is at risk. The other thing is often mom has a lot of allergies and pass that along. If they're at risk, then let's look at what the things that we can do. So we know that they are sugar cravers, and sugar feeds this. And the reason we have many wheats up there, is that not one of the most common things that we do? We start our day out with dessert with children, and then we wonder why they don't do well in school. In fact, the government programs for breakfast are, it would be better if they fasted, because fasting is actually very good for you. When you fast, you clear out debris in your body. Say, oh, they have to have a good breakfast. Well, not if it's going to be the breakfast they provide, right, which is what, donuts and juice. If you would take a Snickers candy bar, you add up the amount of carbs and the amount of sugar in there, it comes to 65 grams. If you put cereal and juice together, you have 70 grams. So, or give them a Snickers in the car, just a lot easier, you know, than doing the bowl and the juice and all of that. As far as this is concerned, he doesn't care whether or not he says, okay, a Snickers candy bar, okay, yes, I'll grow, or juice and cereal, okay, thank you, thank you. It doesn't care. It's not discriminating. It will do the same. And that's the piece that, that is important for us to learn. So as we're going to look at some more things, we see that what does this yeast overgrowth do? Well, we know that one, it's like a Pac-Man. Remember that game Pac-Man? The number one mineral it eats is magnesium. We're going to look at magnesium in detail later because the symptoms of magnesium deficiency and the symptoms of sensory integration processing problems are about the same. So oftentimes, what do we know about magnesium? We know that magnesium is nature's tranquilizer. It relaxes you. And a natural laxative. How many of these kids are on Miralax? It's so much a nature's tranquilizer that some naturopaths and even MDs who are naturally oriented, if your child comes in and has been suffering for asthma for days, we don't mean needs to go into the emergency room and rescue type of thing, just tight in the chest and nothing works, they'll run an IV of B12 and magnesium. Because magnesium, you'll feel it in your body immediately, just warms everything and it dilates. Magnesium dilates. That's why they use MagSulf a lot in for premature labor, those types of things. So magnesium is a very important key to what's going on to these guys. You know that you're low in magnesium if your trapezius muscles are tight all the time. If you would just pay anybody to just massage your shoulders. And if you take magnesium, they don't seem to need that because it's nature's tranquilizer. So we have found that one of the causes of all of this problem tends to be this leaky gut that occurs when we have cavalier use of antibiotics and steroids, or I should even say more than cavalier. It tends to be cavalier if we do it for light infections, doesn't it? Or prophylactic use, I mean, that just isn't as well thought through as we'd like it to be, but mainly unopposed. So if you learn one thing, is that you're not gonna do unopposed estrogen and unopposed antibiotics. They need the opposing pole because we get them so off balance and the equilibrium isn't the same anymore. So let's look at what are some of the things that we think. They said, oh, she prefers cuddling with her cat while taking a nap. So even though she's allergic to the cat, no, let's not get rid of the cat. No, let's give her nasal cort, which is what? Cortisone. And they say, yes, but that's just nasal, or it's inhaled, it's just topical. Now we know that they are using, what's the best delivery system for medicines that they're using now? Nasal gels for heart medications and inhaled. In fact, if you take inhaled steroids, what do they tell you to do? Rinse your mouth out, because what do you get? Thrush, exactly. Well, would you just get thrush in the tongue? No, it's just what part you can see, you can't see all the way down here. And many, in fact, they have found like the third or fourth ear infection a child has is really a fungus ear infection. By then, the fungus grows in that area. Do you know there's fungal pneumonia? And in fact, I have a sister in Duluth, and she works at the University of Minnesota, Duluth branch, and is in charge of the RAs there. And she said they had just a real tragic start to the year because they had two freshmen in a dorm. And one of the freshmen had been suffering with Crohn's disease, but was really under control. And the Crohn's exacerbated so much that he had to go home and have surgery on it. And they didn't know what was the cause. But his roommate was sent home to the hospital with fungal pneumonia. And I said, what happened in that room? You have to have fungus in there. And she looked, they had the grid, and that part of the dorm had during the summer been flooded because the fire extinguishers, the fire shower had gone off. And so it had soaked the rug. What had they gone in? They'd gone in, of course, and taken one of those vacuum suckers, and they'd gotten all the water up. But it obviously happened afterwards. If you'd lift that up, what would you see? You would see mold under there. And that mold was just life-threatening to them. In that confined area, sleeping in it, studying in it. So mold isn't something that they take, that we take lightly. And anything that grows mold casually. So if you're, if the cat is causing allergies, you know, get a fish instead of needle cord. It is hard to get a child well when they're doing still on these types of things. Mayo Clinic found, just talking more about the role of fungus, that's something we didn't realize, how it can so upset these children's nervous system. They found that all chronic sinusitis is really a fungus that is growing, and instead of antibiotics and steroids, doctors should be prescribing antifungal nasal spray. So fungus is much bigger than we think. You know, there are four outside agents that can make us sick. Viruses, bacteria, fungus, and parasites. I have a brother now who teaches at medical school, and he's just a great guy. And he said, you guys do a wonderful job with virus and bacteria, but we don't hear much about fungus and parasites from you. And he said, I know. He said, if we had another year in medical school, we'd teach all of that. But he said, we have the best trauma medicine in the whole world in this country, and that's true, isn't it? We save lives. Babies can be born tiny and live. But he said that we don't do well with chronic things. And so there are four agents. That's what we need to realize, not just virus and bacteria. And with the these kids are on the spectrum, whether it is even just ADD or just an ordinary child, we have found that fungus tends to be the number one thing that to start, that a mother can start doing at home without even having to see a DAN doctor or go to, you know, do that route of testing. They can. The DAN doctor would absolutely help them. We know this. But if, let's say, that they're resistant or money-wise, can't do that. So let's look at, as we know, the physical symptoms of yeast fungus overgrowth. If a child's ever had thrush, if they've had thrush one time, that spore is there, and it wants to keep working in there. Remember, we treat the exit points, not where it's coming from. So I have that on my questionnaire. Did they have thrush as an infant? Because they'll say, I don't know if they're not focusing or if they just can't, their work is too hard, and I'm trying to help them weigh that out. But not, so I'll ask, if I see this thrush in there, I think, ooh, I'm weighing on the side of focusing, because that's upsetting the nervous system. If they have ever put down they're allergic to antibiotics, that's a wonderful red flag, because what are antibiotics? Mold. So their body's saying, I'm filled up with mold up to here. Don't think about putting in more mold. Well, they put it in the form of an antibiotic, and choo, it comes out the body, because it will exit. It wants to exit. So it'll exit as hives. And so they say, well, you know, then that if they're just allergic to penicillin or amoxicillin. No, that mold is a problem, and that's causing all sorts of issues. Athlete's foot. If a child has athlete's foot, if they just have athlete's foot because they were in the gym where they picked it up, it'll go away in about a week. It's topical. But in fact, this is the reason I have this tape set here called the Biology Behavior CD set, because I was talking to Nancy Thomas. Actually, I saw a young boy named Joseph, and he was 11, and he was a reactive attachment disorder young fellow, and he had been actually in group homes. And I didn't know this. Some mother told me that he'd been in therapeutic parenting, but I didn't know that he had been having all this trouble, so much trouble that she didn't think she could keep him. Anyway, he had some little learning issues, nothing big, mainly dysgraphia, but he had chronic athlete's foot. Had it from 2 years old on, could never get rid of it. You know, get rid of it a week, come back. And so anyway, we set up an antifungal program and such for him, and I got a call from Nancy Thomas about 2 months later. Nancy Thomas works with Foster Klein, Jim Fay, and the whole therapeutic parenting. And she travels all over the world and speaks to parents of adopted children. And so she called and she said, tell me what you did